We'll be talking this morning about something that is a common object that's around us all the time. And I'll bet you use one of these every day, probably without thinking a great deal about it, actually. It's one of those things that we take for granted. It is an item that is mass-produced. So the ones that we use now are mass-produced. However, it's also an item that has drawn the interest of many artists and architects. The thing that we're talking about here is the chair. And our guest this morning, Galen Krantz, has written about it in a book that's titled The Chair, Rethinking Culture, Body, and Design. It's published by W.W. Norton. It is now available in a paperback edition. And it explores something of the history of the chair, what it represents, how indeed various architects and artists have looked at the chair and tried to do interesting things with it. And also the book looks at the issue of people, their bodies, and how they fit or sometimes don't fit very well in the chairs that we use. She's here on the campus to talk about this as part of the fall lecture series of the architecture department at the U of I. And she'll be giving her talk at 7 o'clock tonight. All of these take place in the auditorium there at Temple Hoyne Buell Hall, that's the architecture building, Plym Auditorium, at 7, at 608 Taft Drive. And I expect that anybody who is interested should consider themselves welcome to go and hear her. And, of course, you can talk with us this morning. Questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Appreciate it. Chairs at... despite one might think that chairs is something that's, well, you find everywhere, that everybody sits in chairs. In fact, as you write in the book, something between a half and a third of the peoples of the world don't use them. They don't use chairs. Who has chairs and who does not have chairs? Or maybe I should say, who does not generally use chairs?
Well, the part of the world that we sometimes call the third world, but really just cultures who have not been part of the whole process of Westernization. Mm-hmm. And admittedly, that's a smaller and smaller part of the world. But anyway, let's just say India, much of Africa, to some extent China, in traditional Japan, people sat on the floor on tatami mats rather than in chairs. But all of these societies and cultures look to the chair as a symbol of modernization and Westernization. And so they have chairs in business life now, and sometimes people have them even in their apartments, sort of as ceremonial tokens, but even if they don't use them. Yeah, there's still a big hunk of the world that doesn't use them, and I actually would like to encourage them not to adopt the chair wholesale, because as we have begun to sit in them more and more over time, our back problems have gotten worse and worse. So I think there's a relationship between the posture of chair sitting and our back problems.
Yeah. Well, that's something certainly that I want to talk about and get onto. But perhaps let's save that for a little bit, because having made this point about the fact that all peoples generally do not use them, and that it is seen, many people see it as a symbol of modernization and Westernization, as you say. Since not all people sit in chairs, as I'll pose the question that you do in the book, since not all people sit in chairs, why do we sit in chairs?
Yeah, that's a good question, if I do say so myself. I went back and looked at all the secondary material on this. That is, I read what other people wrote, and most of the chair scholars were stopping sometime around the Egyptians and sort of blaming it on the pharaohs, saying they had these upright thrones, and then we copied them, we Westerners copied them. But I thought, well, that doesn't quite satisfy me, because these are very complex civilizations, Egyptian and Mesopotamian, the other, the Fertile Crescent. And so I started asking the archaeologists on the Berkeley campus what was known about chairs before these highly developed civilizations. And lo and behold, yes, Neolithic society did indeed have chairs. And one person told me about a relatively recent dig in the former Yugoslavia, where they found these little kiln-fired figures, only about, say, 2 inches tall, 2.5, of women seated in chairs. And these figures were only found in women's graves. So there's real concrete evidence that chairs go at least back to 7,500 BC. So, and then I asked, well, what about before the last ice age, which would take us back 40,000 years? And the answer was, well, all we have from that period are the cave paintings around the world. And in all those, there's never, ever been an image of a chair. Mostly there's animals, few humans, occasionally a tool, but never a chair. So we will probably never know exactly how far chairs go back in time. But I think we can say that they seem to always be associated with status or some kind of role differentiation, you know, that women are different than men in some way. And there is speculation about that, those Neolithic villages having been matrifocal. So perhaps it was that women had a greater status. But whatever, we can say that the chair differentiates one person from another. So it has something to do with individuality, unlike a bench or a couch, you know, or a bed. There's some kind of elevation and differentiation of the individual.
Hmm. And only one person can sit in it at a time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I guess it's certainly no accident that, as you say, the chairs are associated with status, that, that we refer to the person in charge as being the chairman,
yeah,
or the chairwoman, or the chair. You know, the fact that, and then pronouncements come from
the,
from the chair.
Yes, ex cathedra means in Latin from the chair. That is seems to be, that literal phrase comes from a medieval practice of setting up a table in front of a chair. The chairs were very heavy, ceremonial beasties. They sat. The person who had the right to sit in a chair would sit there, and then a trestle would be set up and some planks set over it. That's called setting the table. Mm-hmm. And you did that, and the chairman then would be the person who had the table set up in front of him. So that honor business has carried right on through medieval times, and I dare say into the present.
Mm-hmm. And after all, the throne is just a big chair, a very big, fancy chair.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting that, you point out that, those kinds of official chairs, like thrones, generally have the seat and the back and all parts of it. They're all right angles, which encourages one to sit up very straight and sort of stiff and tall in an official sort of way. One doesn't lounge in a throne. One sits in a very regal manner in the throne.
Yeah, you preside
in
a throne. There was another chair type that was considered softer and more domestic that originated in the ancient Greek time called the klismos. And it has a back that isn't at right angles to the seat. So it allows you to slouch.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that's such a virtue myself. I think that righteous, upright posture was actually better for the sitter than the slouching that we encourage today.
Our guest, Galen Krantz, is professor of architecture at University of California at Berkeley. She's particularly interested in the sociology of architecture, and she's written on this subject that we're talking about here. She's author of the book, The Chair, Rethinking Culture, Body, and Design. It's published by W.W. Norton. It was first published a couple of years ago and now is available in a paperback edition, if you'd like to look at it. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. Another thing, I guess, that would have at one time made a chair special is that there weren't that many of them. And I think you point out that perhaps in a medieval household, there may only have been one. There would have been other things for people to sit on, but a chair that we would recognize, a big, heavy thing with a big back and arms, there may just have been one chair in the whole house.
That's right. That's exactly right. People sat on on storage boxes that were pushed up around the edges of the central hall in feudal manors. And they sat on three-legged stools. You can see that in a lot of paintings from early Renaissance and late medieval Europe. But the chair was definitely honorific.
It's funny that still today, apparently, we associate the height of the back of the chair as a symbol of status.
That we do. And often, there's some real ironies in this business that some of those big, puffy executive chairs with the very high backs are actually cheaper to produce than the highly adjustable office chairs that the secretary has. But they usually can charge more for the big, high-backed executive model that's in leather for obvious reasons.
At what point do chairs start to become mass-produced items, and does that start people thinking differently about them?
Well, it's the Industrial Revolution when wood didn't have to be turned by hand but could be done by a machine, then you can start churning them out. They used to be, until the Industrial Revolution, chairs, even if you had a set of six, that would be listed in your goods, estate listings and so forth. They were important, in other words. Obviously, they become less important as they become more common. Mm-hmm. And then plastic comes along, and we have those white plastic molded ones that are proliferating everywhere. Those are not important. But even they actually have an importance, because if you walk into somebody's house or an office, the first thing they ask you to do is to have a seat to show respect. So we know that even the lowliest, most common chair still has this remnant of significance attached to it. It's the way you treat a guest. You wouldn't expect them to squat or to sit on the floor or to be kept standing. Kids know to this day that the bigger the chair is, the more important it is. If you go in for an interview, you know full well who sits in what chair. You don't make a mistake and go sit in the boss's chair. There's differentiation that's still built in, even as our chairs become really common and ordinary.
Yeah, that's interesting that there still should be so much status connected with it, and that if it's somehow thrilling and transgressive to sneak into the boss's office. And what is it the person's going to do? They're going to go and they're going to sit in the boss's chair.
Right.
And as if somehow sitting in the chair is taking on the mantle of authority or status or whatever. And that also there's the idea that that's kind of a naughty act to do, to
yes.
go sit in the person's chair.
Yes, and I read that when Vice President Bush was VP, he made great pains never to sit in Reagan's chair when Reagan wasn't there as president, for the very reason that you just said, because he knew it would be naughty. And it would be a transgression.
It would be almost a usurpation in a way for you to say. It would be like going into the throne room and sitting in the king's chair.
Yes.
If you were the number two guy.
Yeah. So he didn't.
It's also kind of interesting that for the fact that chairs were around a long time before people who made chairs started to think very much about comfort. And to put padding in them, and to make it something that would be a little nicer to sit on, as opposed to something that was essentially like a bench, had a very hard straight back and had a hard seat.
Well, now we get into the controversial part of my book about what is the definition of comfort. Mm-hmm. I actually think that up until the 18th century, they used a quarter inch of horsehair for padding. And I think that's probably just about right, the right amount of springiness we need for our little sit bones. The 19th century is responsible for the big spring coil upholstery that goes yung, 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 when you sit on it. And that has problems because you sink into it and the upholstery comes up around the ischial tuberosities, the fancy word for sit bones, and the flesh gets pressed and starts to take on a load-bearing function for which it isn't designed. When you press flesh, you reduce the capacity of the capillaries to work efficiently and for the lymph to flow. So it may actually be more comfortable in the long run to sit upright on a pretty firm surface. But we now think of comfort as short-term ease. And there's been an evolution in our language. Apparently, in the original Latin, to comfort meant to give strength, as to comfort someone in a time of distress. Mm-hmm. Come was with, and fort, strength. Now, instead of to strengthen, it's come to mean to provide yielding ease. And I would propose that we go back to that older definition of long-term structural comfort. Because when you sag or collapse or let your flesh be pressed inappropriately, your circulation is reduced, and you get into long-term discomfort. So I would say we need to rethink our ideas about comfort and take another look at that firmness.
Our guest again this morning, Galen Krantz. She is professor of architecture at the University of California at Berkeley. She specializes in the sociology of architecture. She's the author of the book, The Chair, Rethinking Culture, Body, and Design, and it's published by W.W. Norton. It is now out in paperback, so it's not terribly expensive if you'd like to look at it. Also, for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, she will be speaking this evening on the U of I campus as part of the fall lecture series put together by the Architecture Department, and that will be at 7 o'clock in the Plym Auditorium in Temple Hoyne Buell Hall. That's the architecture building on the U of I campus. And anyone who's interested is welcome. And calls, questions are welcome too. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Another little bit of chair history that I thought was interesting. Apparently the rocking chair was an American invention.
That's what most of the chair scholars believe. They just took a regular chair and carved some runners for the bottom and attached it, and voila, American inventiveness. Hmm. And I think rockers are a very good thing, and I think everybody should have them in their houses. And they come in all styles. You can have a high modern one as well as a folksy colonial one. But what's good about them is that, when you move, you're moving all the joints, the ankle joint, the knee, the hip, and even the whole spine all the way up to the head. So you're getting all those fluids in our joints to be circulated, and that's good. Hmm. And you're subtly changing the way stresses move through your body, the way gravitational forces move through your body. So that's good too, because movement in general is far better than learning how to sit still.
One of the things that I did not mention about you, that maybe I will, is that you're a teacher of the Alexander technique.
Mm-hmm.
And what little I know about this, I know that the idea is that the way that we use our bodies can either be good or bad. That is, in the sense, good body mechanics can result in you being healthier, and if you use your body in the wrong ways, it can cause pain.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that people who do Alexander technique, and particularly they work with people who use their bodies in what they do, dancers, musicians, athletes, but anybody I know can, I know the Alexander folks feel that anybody can benefit by learning properly to use the body. So having said all that, you've already said some things about chairs, the way we sit, and that maybe there are good ways and there are bad ways. What would be the best kind of chair for people to have? Or would it be better if we didn't sit in chairs at all?
Well, sometimes I think it would be better if we didn't sit in them at all. But I won't. What I would say is it's important to have multiple different ways to sit. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the two important alternatives to regular chair seating would be perching, which is where you sit higher than average so that your knees are a lot lower than your hips. We float in outer space like that. It's called the neutral body posture. And if standing is 180 degrees, between spine and thigh.
Mm-hmm.
And sitting is 90 degrees. Mm-hmm. Halfway between would be 135 or 120 in there. That's actually the best for the whole overall body. And then if you rotate that position in space, you end up with a lounge chair. It's the same beneficial relationship between thigh and spine. It's, you know, that on radio, you can't see my hands. Anyway, that you can see it tonight. I'll show it in lecture very clearly with diagrams and my own body. I can act it all out.
Yeah. So, well, and I think I know that people who often people who have back problems, it's recommended that one good thing would be to lie down on your back on a firm surface with your knees with your knees and legs elevated. It's kind of like
knees on the floor, knees up, and feet on the floor. So you make that kind of little pyramid out of your legs.
Right.
We call that constructive rest position or rest mm-hmm. position. That's what we do in the Alexander technique as a way to help people give feedback to their bodies about what a nice, flat, organized back would look like. When your feet are up, it releases the lower back that often gets strained in people, especially with sitting, it gets strained. So, there's two major paths to the Alexander technique. One is the performing arts that you mentioned, and the other is people in pain. So it has a therapeutic application, although we don't call it therapy. We call it kinesthetic education or re-education. We say re-education because as little kids, we move very well. I'll talk more about that later tonight. But depending on class, culture, family dynamics, we lose good posture as we age, not because of aging, but because of these other psychological and cultural forces. And you can unlearn them and regain the grace that is our birthright. Mm. And I'm one of these people who came to this system through pain, but I got hooked on it intellectually and philosophically because I got really excited about the true possibility of mind-body integration. And so that we talk of use of the self rather than posture, because it is the psyche that is using the body to express all this unconscious stuff about inferiority or depression or happiness or pride or boastfulness or whatever. You know, mm-hmm. that whole range mm-hmm. of human emotions are all expressed physically. And this system really thrilled me because it wasn't just talking about mind-body integration. It was embodying it. And it was quite a challenge to the dualism of, our Western education.
Yeah. Given that, I'm going back to chairs here for a second, given that most of the chairs that we're going to encounter maybe in our homes and in our offices and school and every place else you go are going to encourage sitting in that position where everything's right angles. Is there anything that you can do in the way that you use the chair or other sorts of things that you do that can enable you to adopt this other posture, this other lineup?
Yeah, I've tried to be practical in this book besides, theoretical and historical, and I do have a lot of tips. One of them is to, if you're short and your feet always swing over the floor, to use books, a phone book or a set of cookbooks under my dining room table. I have a cookbook that sits there so that my feet are securely on the floor. But more importantly, I think for most of us, would be to do something for the seat. And that is, I actually sit on books on the seat so that I'm raised up enough so that my knees start to become lower than my hips. That's really the trick. Mm-hmm. If you sit, or if you're short, also the other thing to do would be to just walk your sit bones right out to the edge of the seat and then have your feet flat on the ground. And to do that, your knees are going to be lower than your hips. So for you, for a short person, a regular height chair can be created, turned into a perch by sitting right out at the very edge of the chair. That's one of the important tricks of to make regular chair sitting work for you. The other is to sit on something really high, add a phone book so that you get your sit bones are a lot higher than your knees. In car seats, the same thing. They're hollowed out in the bottom usually. So a book wrapped in a towel or a piece of foam or something is useful to bring you up out of that. Many chairs are overly contoured in the backs, so filling that contour in with towels or backboards. My Alexander teachers actually produced a backboard to help take out all those lousy curves in your chair seat, in your car seat, both the seat and the back. And they have a company, Posture Evolution Products, coming out of Katona, New York. So can I give their phone number?
Sure.
Oh, I'll look it up.
Okay. Well, while you're doing that, we have some callers here we want to get to and would certainly invite anybody. We do have just about 10 minutes left, so we'll try to get in as many folks as we can. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line, 800-222-9455, if you'd like to call and talk with our guest, Galen Krantz. From the University of California at Berkeley.
I found that number. Okay. It's an area. There is a 1-800 number, but I don't have it. I have instead their regular number, which is 914-232-9668.
Okay. And the name again is?
It's Posture Evolution Products. And it's unusual in the market because most chair and back supports are for lumbar support. And this one actually takes out those lousy curves. See, I think pushing the lumbar forward is ridiculous. It's the right angle seated posture that flattens the lumbar curve. So the ergonomicist people come along and say, okay, we need lumbar support to recreate that curve. And they try to put this bump in your chair back to push the lumbar back into place. It would be much easier to simply sit higher, have your knees a little lower than your hip sockets, and bingo, the lumbar curve is back in place and you don't need any mechanical shoving around. So, but the great current prevailing myth is we have to have lumbar support, but that's because people are not willing to think outside the box of right angle seated posture. Once, if you are locked into right angle seated posture, yeah, okay, you have to do something to shove the lumbar forward. But if you're willing to think of, oh, maybe we should sit in a perch, then the lumbar comes back and you don't need lumbar support. So what you need is something to take out all these lousy curves that turn your body into a sack. Basically, you don't want to sit in a sack-like configuration because all your internal organs fall in on themselves. You want something firm or planar that your body can open out against and get more volume internally. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's why this product is unusual in the marketplace, because of the current chiropractic and medical myth that you have to have lumbar support.
Let's talk with some people who are listening in Urbana. Line number one. We'll start there. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Yes.
We have a wonderful Alexander community of teachers here in Champaign-Urbana. I didn't know if your guests knew that.
Yes, I do.
Oh, okay. And a wonderful longtime teacher, Jan Murray, in this community. So I just, you know, if people go to your talk and want to do some of the Alexander work, why we have a lot of fine practitioners right here in Champaign-Urbana.
Yes, Jen and Alex Murray and mm-hmm. Joan Shirley. You have a school here.
Right.
So you're very fortunate that you have a lot of resources in this community.
Yes, we are. Just wanted people to know that.
Okay.
I'm glad you brought that up. Thank you.
Thank
very good.
You.
We'll go to hear somebody else. This is Belgium, line number four. Hello.
Yes. I have a question for your guest, and I've listened to your discussion all the way through this morning, and you were talking about historical methods of sitting. And it seems to me probably the most historical method of sitting is to squat. Mm-hmm. Most people in the world still do squat.
Mm-hmm.
If you see people in India or any place else in the world, most of them squat. Well, according to your last discussion, where you want your knees lower than your hips, that doesn't work.
Good. That was smart of you to catch that one. I thought about that a lot myself and tried to figure out why it is that squatting works, and because it does work. And what I realized, your knees are way above your hip sockets. True.
Definitely.
But with squatting, you're not sitting on a surface that stops your tailbone and the lengthening of your spine. So you don't actually lose the elongated S shape of the spine. The spine, it gets very attenuated. But you see, with sitting on a right angle configuration, your spine turns into, you might say, like a big letter C, and you lose the lumbar curve. And we're supposed to have this sort of elongated S, a double set of curves in our spine. When you squat, the S gets really flattened, but it's not lost. It doesn't go to a C. And the tailbone can still dangle. It's not under compression. It's not being compressed by meeting the seat. So you get an actual lengthening and stretching of the whole spine when you squat, because the legs, in effect, are taken out of the way. So it doesn't matter in this case that the knees are way above the hip sockets. It's, you have to think about what's going on with the whole spine, and it's being lengthened and subtly stretched, and it usually feels quite good to squat. And I might say that even Westerners can regain the ability to squat if you practice like less than 30 seconds and then a minute a day. You can get it back.
Then why, if according to what you say there, you want to make sure your tailbone is free hanging, so to speak.
Yeah.
Why don't chairs have holes in the middle?
Well, there is one chair that I've seen one seat.
Other than a toilet.
Yeah, the other throne. there is a little seat pad on the market that has a cutout for the tailbone, exactly for that reason. But most people just don't. I'd say the reason is that status has been more important than physiology in the design of chairs.
I see. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And it certainly, artists, as I've mentioned, sort of artists, architects, a lot of people have looked at the chair and have tried to do sort of interesting things with it. But I'm sure that a lot of people expect a chair to look in a certain way. And if there's something odd about it, like if it had a hole in the seat, you'd think, something's wrong with that.
Yeah, and even a hole in the seat, it would help a little bit, but it still wouldn't undo the biomechanical stresses that the legs at the thighs at right angle to the spine produce for the lumbar curve. That is, when they flatten the lumbar curve, and that would still be there even if you had the little cutout for the tailbone. Mm.
We have some other callers here. I don't know that I'm going to get everybody. In fact, I know I probably won't get everybody. Well, let's go next to next person in line. That's Aurora, and that's line number 2. Hello.
Yes, hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
This is an interesting conversation. I think physically it would be much healthier to sit in a straight chair, like you're saying, that people at one time did not sit in this soft, comfortable, I don't know how comfortable they are, if they cause your back problems, that we have now. My mother would never sit in a soft chair. She never would, for some reason. She never would, and it's interesting to hear you talk about it. The thing that I wanted to ask, the people that sit on the ground and squat, and the people that squat, how do they handle the situation of getting dirty in that position?
Dirty, you mean just like being on the ground?
Yeah, being on the ground.
Well,
yeah.
Often they take their shoes off and leave them outside the house.
So they only sit in the house that way. I'm referring to people that squat outside.
When they wait for the bus or something like that. Yeah, they just. Well, they don't touch the ground. If they squat, they don't touch the ground any more than we do. Their shoes are on the ground, or their feet are, and they hang on their thighs, and their butt doesn't touch the ground.
I've tried to sit in that position because I think it's healthy for you to sit that way. It's a good exercise.
Yep.
But I have difficulty handling, and maybe I'll try it after your program.
Well, of course, you know, when we haven't done it for a lifetime, it's difficult. When you reintroduce these postures, you have to be very cautious and slow. You know, no more than a minute a day, but it has to be every day.
Yeah.
And you know, kids, when they get to do it, when you do it from kid life on, it's different than reintroducing it as an adult.
I'm going to jump in here. My apologies to the caller and to a couple of other people here we can't take, but we're simply going to have to stop because we have used the time. For people who are interested in this subject, I certainly would suggest you look at the book that our guest has written because it explores the history of the chair. It looks at the subject that we really haven't touched on, that is some interesting things that artists and architects have done in terms of chair design, and the issue of ergonomics and health and the way that we sit. All of that is explored in the book, and it's titled The Chair, Rethinking Culture, Body, and Design. It is now published it was published first in hardcover and now in paperback by W.W. Norton, and it should be in bookstores if you want to look at it.
And maybe a book signing tonight.
Oh, we were going to check on that. We're not so sure about that. But we can say for sure that if you're in Champaign-Urbana, here in and around the university community, you can hear more from our guest, Galen Krantz, from University of California, Berkeley. She'll be talking about this very subject in a lecture that's sponsored by the Department of Architecture. That's tonight at 7 o'clock at Temple Hoyne Buell Hall, the architecture building on the U of I campus. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate it.